Welcome, everyone, to Creating a Family, talk about adoption and foster care. I'm Dawn Davenport, your host and the director of Creating a Family. Today, we're going to be talking about the legal process of adoption, most specifically, what you need to know before you adopt. We'll be talking today with Britton Wright. He began practicing adoption law in North Carolina after adopting two children, both of whom are now married adults. Congratulations on there, Britton. Since then, Britton has represented many adoptive parents, many birth mothers, and has worked to improve North Carolina adoption laws. Welcome, Britton, to Creating a Family.
Thank you.
I should also add that you are a member of Quad A, and you want to tell us what Quad A stands for?
Yes. It used to be the American Academy of Adoption Attorneys, but 3 or 4 years ago, the name was changed to the Academy of Adoption and Assisted Reproduction Attorneys.
Excellent. Yes. And it does go by Quad A, but it is an organization of attorneys that practice adoption and assisted reproductive law. All right. So let's jump in. And one thing I always tell people is we encourage people when they have questions, especially if they're not working with an agency that has an attorney, that they need to seek help from an attorney. And when you seek help from an attorney, it's important that they be an attorney that specializes in adoption law. And that's not necessarily the same thing as a family law attorney. So keep that in mind as you move forward. All right. So adoption is the legal process of transferring the permanent parent-child relationship from the parents of birth to the adoptive parents. And adoption provides the adoptive parents the rights and responsibilities of a legal parent, as if the child had been born to them. And the adoptee becomes their legal heir, becomes the legal heir to the adoptive parents. So let's start by saying, what kinds of adoption are there?
Well, it depends on how you slice it up, because adoptions generally divide into agency adoptions, and those are adoptions where a birth mother entrusts her baby to an agency, and the agency entrusts the baby to the adopting parents, or independent, also called direct placement adoptions, on the other hand, where the birth mother entrusts her baby directly to the adopting parents. And so we've got this two things parallel, but we also can divide up adoptions into relative and non-relative adoptions, depending on whether the birth mother or birth father and the adopting parents are related to one another. And we can also divide up adoptions between in-state and interstate adoptions, depending on whether the child is being adopted by people who live in the same state where the child is born, or whether the child is being adopted by people who live in a different state. And then there are also adoptions that have to be done under a federal procedure, still in state court, but under a federal procedure because the child is considered to be an American Indian child.
Mm-hmm. And that's kind of a separate thing, and we really won't go into too much detail on that because if that's involved, then you need to be working with someone who knows a lot about the Indian Child Welfare Act. Okay.
When you slice up adoptions those four different ways, you get 16 kinds of adoptions, because it could be an agency, non-relative, interstate adoption. And so, for instance, all of those are a little different, but they all have rules that you have to follow. And, Dawn has already given my main theme too, which is, get a lawyer.
Yeah. And often if you're working with an agency, the agency has a lawyer and you will be working with the agency's lawyer. But adoption is an area of law. It's a specialty of law. So that's important to recognize that. And you're not expected to know everything. But it does help to have, a general overview before you get into it. And one thing that I think is almost universally not known outside of those of us who are attorneys, is that adoption is governed by state law. And therefore, that means that really we have 50 plus the territories and plus DC and everything else, many adoption laws that work in the United States. So it's important for you to consult with an attorney or an attorney that works for your agency that knows the laws and the state where you or the expectant parent or the birth parent resides in order to know exactly what law should govern. But I have a question about that. Do the adoptive parents have to comply with the laws of the state where the expectant parent resides or where the baby is born or where they reside?
Well, the answer is probably yes. you don't want to break the law.
A little of A, B, a little of B, a little of C, huh?
Well, you don't want to break the law in any jurisdiction. When you start looking at the procedure you're going to use, it could be in the law where the baby's born, or it could be where the adopting parents live. And that's the choice that sometimes has to be made, or it's a choice that can't be made because the state law where the baby is born says you have to do this in our court using our procedure.
Mm-hmm. So the answer is it depends.
That's right.
Okay. So I've just said that adoption is governed by state law. Are there any federal laws other than the Indian Child Welfare Act that govern adoption?
Well, primarily it is the Indian Child Welfare Act and the Service Member Civil Relief Act, because if there is a birth father who's in the military and is on active service, that birth father has rights under the Service Member Civil Relief Act, which is an act that basically it exists to make sure that if you sue somebody in the military and they're off fighting a war, you can't get a default judgment against them because they don't show up in court. And it's broad enough to cover adoptions.
Oh, that makes sense. Okay, you had mentioned and that it is possible, in fact, it is fairly common, to adopt a child in another state. You live in one state, the child is born in a different state, interstate adoption. And there is a compact, the Interstate Compact on the Placement of Children. That's a fancy name, but that is going to impact the parents in the process. If you adopt a child in another state, what is the Interstate Compact on the Placement of Children and how does it impact parents who are adopting a child from a different state?
Well, the Interstate Compact is not a federal law, but it kind of feels like it is. It is an agreement among all the states that regulate the taking of a child from one state to another for the purpose of adoption. And it exists to make sure that a child doesn't fall through the cracks, that a child's placed for adoption in state A and then goes to state B. And then the people who have the child in state B 6 years later or 5 years later show up at kindergarten and want to enroll the child, and the child hasn't even been adopted. So it's a system where each state has an office that is in charge of reviewing interstate adoptions. And so it's a gatekeeper. They want to make sure that everything is being done correctly and that there actually can be an adoption in the state where the baby's going, or there'll be an adoption in the state where the baby comes from, and it will apply everywhere. And also that once the baby goes from state A to state B, that there's some adoption agency that's following the welfare of the baby after the fact, so that if there's no adoption, then this agency can report that to the state and something can be done.
And this would apply only to infants, or does it also apply to older children who are being adopted from another state?
It applies to all children.
Okay. All right, and the main thing you need to know as a parent is that this ICPC, as it is known, will impact. You have to comply with the steps required by that state. And what it practically means is that there will be, if you travel to another state to pick up a baby born in that state or a child born in that state, you need to allocate enough time. Your attorney or your agency will be working through the process, but you need to allocate and expect to spend a certain amount of time in that state to allow this process to work through. About what do you recommend for people? I know there is absolutely no guarantee, but what in general do you recommend for people to plan on? How long do they recommend that they stay, that they plan on staying?
Generally, I tell folks to plan on having permission to take the baby back home to their state a week to 10 days after the baby's discharged from the hospital, if we're talking about a newborn. And we try to beat that. I mean, part of this is managing of expectations. So it's sometimes possible for it to be as short as 3 or 4 business days, but it's not something anybody's in a position to guarantee.
Right. Yeah. And it's not always within your control either, since you're working with the Interstate Compact Act for department in another state. So you have been practicing adoption law for a long time. What are some of the primary reasons you see with the expectant parents that you work with for making an adoption plan for their child?
Well, there's really only one reason, and that is because especially in terms of the birth mother, her circumstances make it so that's essentially her only choice. About half of the adoptions I work on, I represent birth mothers, and the other half I represent adoptive parents. And my experience, birth mothers, nobody wants to place a baby for adoption, mm-hmm. but birth mother has to consider her needs, has to consider the child's needs, has to consider the needs of any other children that she has. And sometimes it just becomes apparent that adoption, even though she doesn't want to do it, is the best of all the options that she has before her.
Mm-hmm. And it is no one goes into this with the expectation. No one goes into a pregnancy with the expectation that this is their plan A. So it is usually always a crisis situation or something that is deeply thought through. And as you say, at that point, she believes it is her only option.
That's right. And I make it a point never to ask my birth mother client, do you want to place this child for adoption? It's always in terms of, is this the choice that you feel like you have to make?
Mm-hmm. And we always hope that they have received unbiased, independent counseling that includes all of her options, including the option of how she could make parenting work. That's important that for us to think about when we're talking about birth parents as well, or for in this case, expectant parents. All right, let's talk about adoption, the legal process of adoption from the birth parent's perspective, or they may well be expectant parents, since we generally don't call them birth parents until after the birth. So let's talk about the legal process for the expectant or birth parent perspective. We'll start with the voluntary versus involuntary relinquishment. What do you mean by that?
Well, a voluntary relinquishment or surrender or consent to adoption is a birth mother deciding that this is the route she has to go, and she signs the papers. Involuntary is an entirely different thing. It could mean that the Department of Child Protective Services has taken the child and has terminated the mother's rights and turned it into an agency adoption and are placing the baby. That would be an involuntary situation. Another involuntary situation would be if birth mother voluntarily places a baby, but the biological father has not consented, and his rights have to be resolved in the court in the adoption. And so if he doesn't consent to the adoption, then the termination of his rights may be involuntary on his behalf.
Is when we talk about termination of parental rights, is that the same thing as an involuntary relinquishment?
It is. Some states do a termination of parental rights in all adoptions. It's two stages. The parents consent or not consent, but the court terminates parental rights, and then that court or another court hears the adoption and issues an adoption decree. In other states, and North Carolina is one of those, it's a one-step thing where when the adoption decree is issued, that terminates the parental rights of the birth mother and the birth father.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that again goes back to it depends on what state you are in, okay?
It depends a lot. The different states' adoption laws are amazingly different from mm-hmm. one another.
They really are. And here we're going to come to another example of where they are often very different, and that is, when can an expectant mom voluntarily, or in a birth mom, depending on when we're talking about, voluntarily relinquish her parental rights?
It's going to depend on the statutes of the state that she is relinquishing under. A birth mother in one state can elect to consent to an adoption under the law of another state if that's where the baby is going. So sometimes she has a choice in that. But there are states that say, birth mother can sign before the baby's born, but can revoke the relinquishment anytime after the baby's born up to a certain time or up to a court hearing or something. There are states that say you have to wait so many hours, like 72 after the baby's born, and then birth mother can sign a consent to adoption, and it is irrevocable at that point. You know, it's always subject to fraud or duress, but when a birth mother can say, I was forced to sign it, she can always come in and say that. But in general, in the absence of fraud or duress, some of these states, the moment that she signs, it's irrevocable. Mm-hmm. In North Carolina, it's a different state, and there are other states that follow this pattern where a birth mother will sign a consent to adoption, and a certain number of days after she signs the consent, it becomes irrevocable. In North Carolina, it's generally 7 days. It varies because it can't end on a weekend or a holiday. But they're okay. Very, very different. That's one of the things people need to think about in an interstate adoption, is have the lawyers talk about which is the best state's law to use.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I think it's important to also note that the time that is written in the different statutes for how long the mother has to before she can sign relinquishment papers or voluntary relinquishment papers is a minimum. She can take longer if she wants to. I think that sometimes adoptive parents get confused about that, but it is a minimum of how long she has to be able to sign after the fact. Is there any difference for we've talked about the birth mom voluntarily relinquishing her rights and the law specifying how many hours after birth she has to wait before she could sign those papers. Is there anything different? Are birth fathers treated differently than birth mothers?
Birth fathers are often treated differently in that in many places, many states, a birth father can consent to the adoption before the birth of the baby, and the birth mother can't.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And are there, is that irrevocable? Do the birth fathers also have a revocation period and of course you're speaking for every state here, but so you may not know all 50 states plus the territories, but from your experience, do most states give fathers also a revocation period or no?
States that have a revocation period for the birth mother usually have one for the birth father as well.
Okay.
And if the birth father signs long enough before the baby is born, it's not uncommon that a birth father's consent has become irrevocable before the baby is born.
Okay. So the period, it starts running from when he signs. As people can tell, this adoption is is a legal process. Do expectant parents, or if it's after birth, birth parents, have to have their own legal representation? We were talking about what the parent the rights are for the adoptive parents, but birth parents also need to have their rights protected. So do they have to have separate legal representation?
I always recommend that. As I said, about half of the adoptions that I work on, I do represent the birth parents. There are good reasons for that. It protects the birth parents' rights. Later on, and you will recall, I said, well, what if there's fraud or duress? It's much harder to prove fraud if the birth parents have their own lawyer, because they're not in a position to say, I didn't have a lawyer, they had a lawyer, their lawyer tricked me, I want my baby back. It helps to make sure it's done right. It helps to make sure that everybody's protected.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that is a question to make sure you ask your agency or your attorney. What if the birth parent is a minor? We treat minors differently under the law. So what happens then if a birth parent is a minor? Do their parents have to give consent?
It depends on the state law. There are states that say that if you can have a baby, you can consent to the adoption. There are other states that may say that the birth parent has to come into court and be questioned by the judge and consent. And I say that in the case of an interstate adoption, I worry a little bit about an underage child making the election to have a different state's law apply. So it does come into play, even if the state where you're going to file the adoption has a rule that a minor can sign an adoption consent. Mm-hmm. Question being, can a minor elect to have another state's law apply? And that, I don't think anybody's ever answered that question. So we try to be conservative.
Yeah, something to be considered with if the birth parent is a minor. All right, we've talked about the, at this point it's after the birth, so that the we've talked about birth parents voluntarily relinquishing their parental rights. How long or do they have a period of time after they sign the relinquishment papers to change their mind? Again, assuming there is no fraud or duress, because they obviously have the right to change their mind, or obvious or not, they do have the right to change their mind if they can prove that that the signature was obtained fraudulently or under duress. But absent that, how long do they have after they sign the papers to change their mind and say, I've changed my mind, I want to parent?
In some states, when the adoption consent or relinquishment or surrender is signed, it is irrevocable, and it doesn't matter if the birth parent changes her mind, it's too late. There are other states that have a varying period of time. It can be anywhere from a week to a month.
That's at that point that she has to change her mind just because she changed her mind. Does she have to have a valid, whatever valid would be, but a legally valid reason, or can it just be, I've changed my mind?
If you're within the period that you're allowed to revoke a consent, you don't have to give a reason. You have the right to do that. And in many states, that means you have the right to immediate return of the child. At least one other state, you can still argue over custody of the child after there's been a revocation of a consent. So it's going to depend on the state law.
Mm-hmm. And that's a huge distinction, especially from a birth parent standpoint. What happens if the expectant mom is not able to identify the baby's father?
Most states require that the father be given notice of the adoption if he doesn't consent to the adoption. Also, it's good practice in many cases to, even if birth mother gives a name for a father, you may wish to resolve the rights of any unknown father in case she left somebody out. And the way that's usually handled is through a publication of notice in a newspaper. Another way to do it, in some states the lawyers there like it, and that is a putative father registry, where if a man engages in sexual intercourse with a woman, he's deemed to know that she might have a baby. And if he wishes to have direct notice, then he can go to the state and make a request to be included on the putative father registry of that state to make sure that he gets notice of any adoption. In some states, the law says that if he doesn't do that, he's consenting automatically to the adoption. So it's another thing that varies state to state.
Yeah. And so that is, again, reason that your agency or your attorney will be able to advise you on what they need to do on your behalf or on the birth mother's behalf as well at that point. Big news, everyone. The Jockey Being Family Foundation has provided us with scholarships for free access to 5 of our most popular courses. You can find these courses and the coupon code at the website bit.ly/JBF support. That is bit.ly/JBF, then cap S for support. So JBFS, that's all capitalized, then UPPORT. Again, the coupon code to get you these courses free is going to be on that page as well. And the courses are Raising Resilient Kids with Dr. Ken Ginsberg, Raising a Child with ADHD to a Successful and Healthy Adulthood with Dr. Ned Halliwell, Unexpected Stresses for Newly Adoptive Parents, Practical Solutions to Typical Food Issues with Dr. Katja Rao, and Parenting Children Who Have Experienced Trauma with Karen Buckwalter. Make sure you go to the bit.ly/JBF support to get information on these courses. All right, we've talked about the legal process as it works with expectant and birth parents, or as it applies to expectant and birth parents. Let's talk about it now from the adoptive parent perspective. As far as I know, all states require a home study and a background check. Is that right? I just don't know of any that don't. Do you? Is that universally required, a home study and a background check?
It is certainly universally required where people who aren't related to each other are the parties in the adoption. Most states have exceptions for, say, a birth mother who places the child with her parents for adoption. And many times you don't need a home study for that, even though there may be a requirement that an agency follow up after the fact.
Gotcha. Okay. And so home study and background were not necessary. Are for relative adoptions, may or may not be, depending on the state law. And I would assume the same would be for step-parent adoptions.
Step-parent adoptions, there are states that don't require any home study at all. There are states that don't require home study, but also require that an agency follow up and make a report to the court to make sure everything's good. There are other states where the court can waive that. For instance, if the child has been with the step parent for a number of years, the requirement of even the follow up by the agency can be waived.
Okay. Do adoptive parents have to work with an adoption agency, or do they have the option to work with an adoption attorney without the presence of an agency, or does it depend on what state they live in?
All of those things.
I'm giving you a lot of the all of the above type questions, right?
There are states that are what we call agency states, where the law pushes everyone to go through an agency for the adoption. There's many states, though, where if an adopting parent, a prospective adopting parent, can find an expectant parent and make an adoption plan, they can go ahead and do that without the intervention of an agency.
Okay, but working through an attorney. Okay. And then I believe that there are different states have different requirements on what they will allow adoption attorneys to do, whereas some states will say that an adoption attorney can do the legal part, but they cannot be involved with matching or finding an expectant parent that is considering adoption and suggesting that parent to the adoptive parents or vice versa. And other states allow the adoption attorney to act in many ways like an agency.
That is exactly right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. As we go back to what Brenton said at the very beginning, is that the state laws are really very different in what they will allow. I just want to put in a quick plug for how important I think counseling is for birth parents and the or expectant parents who are making the decision, or birth parents after the birth, that most agencies, although not all, but most agencies do require or do provide, I shouldn't say require, do provide counseling for birth parents. And some continue to provide that long after the birth, and some have no time limit on it. And when working with adoption attorneys, that is something that often adoptive parents have to pay a la carte, have to pay separately. But I think it is just crucial that counseling be provided. So I will throw that in at this point for what it is worth.
I advise my clients to offer counseling as being, among other things, besides being the right thing to do, to be something in their interest, because it's important to understand that when a mother places her child for adoption, it is the hardest thing she's going to do in her life ever. Mm-hmm. And when she is prepared, it makes it a little bit better, because there are young birth mothers, and I see this all the time, that make the assumption that they can essentially go through the process and stay in denial, and it's not going to be a big deal. But the problem there is that when the baby's born, the baby becomes the center of the universe, and everything changes. And if birth mother has been prepared by counseling, she's much in a much better position to deal with that. And there's also somebody who can sit with her after the baby's born and say, yes, the baby is the center of the universe, but remember, we discussed your reasons for placing a child for adoption, and let's go over them and make sure that you still think they're valid or not. And I think that's very helpful.
Well, and the last thing as an adoptive parent you want is for a birth mother to feel like she made the wrong decision. Now, I think it's very common for not regretting the decision per se, but regretting that they were in the position to have to make the decision. I don't think anybody feels great about having had to make the decision, but you don't want a birth parent feeling that they wish that if they had it to do over again, they wouldn't do it. They regret the decision, other than they regret the decision itself, not the position that they were in it. They felt they had to make that. So all of those are things that when working with a counselor, a expectant mom or dad at that point can come to terms with and really make certain that this is the right decision. And hopefully they can hearken back to that as they move forward and make peace with the decision that they did make. All right. Now let's talk about the what is the process for, as our audience has probably figured out, adoptive parents can find expectant parents on their own, to expectant parents who may be considering adoption. They can find them on their own, or they can work through an agency or attorney who finds expectant parents who are considering and they are matched. What is the process for the latter one, when the agency or attorney, if allowed by state law, are the ones who find the expectant parents and then make the match between the expectant parents and the adoptive parents? Just roughly, I mean, it varies by agency, of course, but roughly, what does that process look like?
Well, from the adopting parent's point of view, and I have been there twice in my life, what you do is whatever the agency says do, you do it. Meanwhile,
for sure.
you're, you're trusting the agency to have the relationship with the birth mother. You're trusting the agency to counsel the birth mother, and you're trusting the agency to go to the hospital when the baby's born and obtain the proper legal documents so that you can adopt. And then the agency turns around and as a adoptive parent, you sign an agreement with the agency places the baby with you, and then you go forward and adopt the baby.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And how does that process differ if the adoptive parents find the expectant parents on their own?
It differs a good bit. Let me say that an agency adoption is generally going to cost more than an independent adoption because the adopting parents are now doing things that otherwise the agency would have done for them or for the birth mother. So now you have an adopting parent who actually is developing a relationship with the birth parent, and the adopting parent, it may come to the point where adopting parents are taking birth mother to the doctor. They are seeing to birth mother's needs. They are hiring a lawyer for the birth mother who's going to do the getting of all the documents that are necessary. So when they go to court, they'll have a sufficient adoption. And they hire their own lawyer to file the adoption in court and shepherd the case through to a decree of adoption. So it's considerably different.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is. And generally in that scenario, the adoptive parents are paying for a lot of services a la carte. They're paying for the services that might be included in the entire agency package. And I do worry in that scenario, who is counseling the birth mom on her options and making certain that they present all of her options, including parenting options. So I do worry in those scenarios. It could certainly be done, but it takes forethought and it takes a choice by the adoptive parents to make certain that that happens. Can adoptive parents advertise, and I put that in quotes, when, you know, seek through advertisement expectant parents who are considering placing their child, is that allowed?
I think it's allowed in a number of states.
The other side of that coin is that it is not allowed in other states.
Well, yes, I think before you begin to use media to advertise your availability to adopt it, first thing to do is check and make sure it's legal.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And sometimes we find that adoptive parents, will start advertising, not realizing that in fact, that given their state or where the state where the birth mom is, it or the expectant mom is, it may be illegal. So that's something to look into before you start advertising. What do we mean? We hear the term a legal risk adoption. What does that mean?
It generally means two things. It means either that the adopting parents receive the baby into their arms and into their home during the period of time where the baby's birth mother has the right to revoke her consent and receive the return of the baby. Mm-hmm. So they're at risk for having to return a baby, which is very difficult. It's very, very hard. The other form of legal risk is where birth mother places a baby with adopting parents, but the rights of the biological father have not been resolved. And the adopting parent's attorney or the agency is in the process of getting the court to the point where the court says that this person's consent is not required, that this birth father's consent is not required. And there's risk involved in that because depending on what the birth father has done and depending on what the legal standards are in the state, it may turn out that his consent will be required. And if he doesn't give that consent when it's required, then the adoption will fall through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. And what rights do adoptive parents have They've matched with the expectant mom or expectant parents. The baby is born. The birth parents have not, or the at that point just parents, have not signed their revocation of parental rights or the relinquishment of parental rights. Do the adoptive parents have any rights at that time?
Well, in the hospital, the birth parents might grant the adopting parents right to have access to the baby. They might grant custody temporarily pending the consent to adoption being signed. But in general, there aren't any rights in the prospective adoptive parents until the proper legal documents are signed.
Mm-hmm. Just because you have a verbal agreement with an expectant mom that she is planning on placing her child with you, that does not give you rights. She has to relinquish her parental rights before that will happen. Okay, guys, now it's the time that I get to ask you for a favor. As you know, or at least I hope you know, Creating a Family is a nonprofit. No, I'm not going to ask you for money, although I do hope if you like this show that you will contribute to our Special Needs Parenting Scholarship Fund at the URL creatingafamily.org/scholarship. But that's not the favor I'm asking you for today. Today it's easier. In fact, it couldn't be easier. All I want you to do is tell your friends about this podcast. Most people find out about podcasts by word of mouth. And we would really, really appreciate your sharing with your friends, both in person and online, about this podcast. They can subscribe on whatever device they listen to podcasts on. So please share the news about this podcast that is dedicated to providing unbiased, expert-based information for your adoption and foster care journey. And we thank you. Right. So, we've talked about the cost of adoption when you were saying that, generally speaking, agency adoptions cost a bit more than independent adoptions. So what are some of the factors that will influence the cost of adoption, be it through an agency or through just independent adoption where you're working independently with an attorney?
Well, all of these things we've been talking about, such as whether it's an interstate adoption, that's going to be more expensive than an in-state adoption. An adoption where the birth parents are in a relationship and they will both sign a consent to adoption or relinquishment to an agency, and everybody's confident that that they are the biological parents, that the father is the father. That is going to typically be less expensive than one where you have to go to court and deal with the father's rights. If the father's in the military, if the child may be an Indian child under the Federal Indian Child Welfare Act, that will cost more. Those are the main things that tend to affect the cost.
Yes. And you mentioned birth mother support, different depending on how much the state allows. Different states vary widely on what they allow adoptive parents to pay and how that's early, right, in the pregnancy. How long?
Right. I should have mentioned that the you're not required to pay birth mother expenses, but birth mother is also not required to place the baby with you. So the question is what birth mother expenses are allowed and what gets worked out with the birth mother. Under some circumstances, the law might give an prospective adopting parent a right to the return of some of those expenses if the birth mother doesn't place. If birth mother, for instance, was collecting from two different families, which is fraudulent, the law says you can get the money back. I say you can't, and this is Wright's law of adoption, that you can't get it back because it's not there.
Mm-hmm. Right. So it's true. And also there's you don't want to make it look like if a mother has to make the placement because she can't afford to give you her child back. If she doesn't have the money, she doesn't have the money. And chances are really good the money won't be there.
Right. Mm-hmm. Chances are nearly 100% the money won't be there.
Right. Exactly. Nearly 100%. In fact, let's just say 100%. All right. So the pre-birth placement process. So before the baby is born, what are some things that may happen? Now, you've been matched with a, and generally, let me mention that usually now, not always, but usually now, the birth parents or the expectant parents are the, for, we're talking infant adoption here. The expectant parents select the adoptive parents. Usually they have prepared and they have selected you because you have contacted them independently and they have found you that way. Or if they're working through an agency, they will have been presented with profiles on various parents. So that's, we're talking infant adoption here. With foster care adoption, it is handled differently. Usually there is a placement committee that meets and makes decisions on best interests, but oftentimes it is the current foster family that is given the option if an adoption outside of the family is going to take place. So now let's go back and talk about, so you have been matched with, or a birth mother has an expectant mom, because it's pre-birth, has selected you as a adoptive family. What are some things that may happen? Can you meet in person?
You can always meet in person in an independent adoption. In an agency adoption, and remember, agency adoptions used to always be confidential, and you never knew who your corresponding party was. If you're the birth parent, you'd never know who the adopting parent is, and vice versa. But in the more modern times, that can be waived with the consent of all concerned, so that you may be able to meet a birth parent, or a birth parent may be able to meet an adopting parent. Personally, even in an agency adoption, there may be some rules about not exchanging last name or something like that. But I think the agencies have found that in order to have any business in this day and time, they have to be more flexible about that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I hear very few who, if meeting over Zoom or video, if they don't live nearby, I hear a very few who do not meet. And quite frankly, I think it's pretty antiquated to not be sharing last names and information such as that, because this is something, this woman is making a decision to find somebody who is going to raise her child. So I think more often, I think that has shifted somewhat from what I can see in our groups that we talk with. So how much information is exchanged about both the expectant parents and the adoptive parents? The adoption agency has a fair amount of information about the expectant parents, and they also have a fair amount of information about the adoptive parents, because they've conducted a home study and done background checks, and that involves things like looking at your medical history, looking at your arrest records if you have one, criminal records, your finances, and things like that. So how much information is shared? Does the agency or the attorney, if the attorney is the one doing this, share between let's start with information about the expectant parent. How much information does the agency share about the expectant parent with the adoptive parents?
The agency will share a certain amount of information. Sometimes, if it's not an identified adoption, if the expectant parents and the adoptive parents, they don't know who each other are, there's going to be a certain amount of information, and a lot of it can be redacted so that you can't use it to identify the other person. But generally, the agency will at least give adopting parents a picture of the, and I don't mean photograph picture, but a descriptive picture of the birth parents that would give some idea of what they're like, what their experiences and education have been, what their family history has been, and what the family health history has been, to the extent that that can be gathered, so that the adopting parents can go forward and have the same sort of mental picture of their adopted child's background that they would have if their child had been homemade.
Mm-hmm. And this is good, because it is good for children. Number one, we should mention that most adoptions in the United States have some degree of what we call openness, and we're going to talk about that in a minute. But as that means that there will be information exchanged throughout the child's life. But even in a closed adoption, which fully closed adoptions are fairly rare right now, but even in a fully closed adoption, if at all possible, we as adoptive parents should want to have as much information as we can about our child's first family so that we can share this information with our child, because it's going to be, generally speaking, adoptive people tell us that that type of information is very important to them. So we should be seeking that information and beyond just medical history and things such as that. You know, what talents do they have? Did they like sports? Did they have pets and love pets? Things like that are important for parents to have to share with their children. So anyway, hopefully that type of information, many agencies and attorneys are gathering that type of information. But as I said, so often now, the adoptions, that information can continue to be gathered after the adoption because there is some degree of openness. All right, so how much information about the adoptive parents are shared with the expectant parents before they make a choice on who to select, assuming it's they who are making the choice?
That would be anywhere from a profile, which could be several pages with pictures and general story, all the way to a copy of the home study. And it depends on the state law. And it also depends on what the birth parent asks for.
Interesting. All right. So state law might require all that, but a birth parent also has the right to say that the unfortunate thing is that very often birth or expectant parents don't really know to ask for this, but they could ask for a copy of the home study if that was important to them.
Yes, yes, they could, because there is, to a certain degree, the expectant parents are in the driver's seat until they sign documents and suddenly they're not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, unfortunately, that is how it goes. It's who has the power. We have an article on our site about who has the power in adoption. And it shifts rather dramatically after the papers have been signed and the revocation period is over. How can adoptive parents know if they're being given, well, let me ask this both ways. How can both sets of parents, the expectant parents or birth parents and the adoptive parents, know if they're being given all the information that they've requested? Do they just ask for full disclosure? How do they know if they're getting it?
You know, there has to be some trust involved in it, because you can only learn so much by objective means. Certainly, if you know the other person's identity, you can check them out on the internet, and you can you generally trust the representations that people make to the agency about the adopting parents. The first parents are not always as reliable in terms of reporting all information, and that's a risk that is inherent in adoption.
Mm-hmm. Well, and honestly, I think sometimes adoptive parents are not always honest and forthcoming either, particularly if things are not in records that they have to produce, they can also obfuscate some of the information. So I think it goes both ways, especially if it's information that they feel like might make them less desirable for a birth mother or an agency to choose them.
I do advise my clients to be totally candid with the agency, first of all, because it's the right thing to do. But secondly, and this is also important, if the agency thinks that an adoptive parent is not telling them the truth, that's the kiss of death.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. And so many things are known now that it's awfully hard to disguise some, but it's still possible, but it isn't the right thing to do. So there is that. All right. I've mentioned open adoption, and I've seen varying statistics, but the reality as to how high, but it is a high percentage of adoptions that are currently taking place, infant adoptions, I should say, that are currently taking place in the United States, that the vast majority have some degree of openness. And I should say, openness is not a defined term. So it's up to the parties to define what they mean by openness. But it generally means some type of contact, if it be, it may not be in person, but it may be by phone, by letter, by something post-adoption. Is openness and adoption legally enforceable, even if you put it in a contract or even without a contract? Is that something that either set of parents can try to enforce legally?
It depends on the jurisdiction. In some jurisdictions, some states, it can be laid out in a memorandum and everybody knows what their expectations are, but it's not enforceable in court. In other jurisdictions, an agreement is enforceable. It's it's called a PACA, post-adoption contact agreement. And yet other states, it's only enforceable if it's included in a court order.
Mm-hmm. And even then, if a judge deems that it is not in the child's best interest, I can't imagine a judge enforcing an open adoption if the parents present, the adoptive parents present it as not in the child's best interest and has support for that. Would you agree with that, Brenton?
Yes. When you look at the bundle of rights and responsibilities of a parent, there are a lot of responsibilities. But then when you go over to the rights of the parent side, the right to determine with whom your child associates is pretty much it. You know, you can you know, maybe inherit from them. That's an extreme situation. So, and that comes along with the responsibility to act in the best interest of the child. Mm-hmm. And a well-drafted agreement would acknowledge that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do think that, and I know you represent birth parents, and I'm sure you point that out to them, that it's, even if you have an agreement, if the adoptive parents believe and present this information to the court that it's not in their child's best interest to have openness or have contact of any form with the birth parents, I just don't think it's going to be enforced. So that is the risk that birth parents take going forward. Yeah. This show, as well as all the many resources provided by Creating a Family at our website, creatingafamily.org, could not and would not happen without the generous support of our partners, who not only believe in our mission of providing unbiased education and support to pre- and post-adoptive foster and kinship families, but they believe in that mission so much that they're willing to put their money where their mouth is. One such partner is Vista Del Mar. They are a licensed nonprofit adoption agency with over 65 years of experience helping to create families. They offer home study only services as well as full service infant adoption, international adoption home studies, and post-adoption and foster to adopt programs. You can find them and get more information about them at vistadelmar.org. Okay. Now let's talk about the post-birth process. Now the baby is born. Who makes the medical decisions for the newborn? And I'm going to guess it depends on whether papers have been signed, but let me ask that question. Who makes the medical decisions? An infant has been born. Who gets to make these decisions?
That's exactly right. The birth mother is the patient and the child is the patient and birth mother's in charge of the child until she transfers those rights to an adopting parent, assuming she does. And at that point, you know, she's transferring custody, she's transferring the right to make these decisions. You know, the question of circumcision comes up sometimes. Who makes that decision? Well, it depends on when the decision is made.
And oftentimes, the birth parents and the adoptive parents may be discussing these issues jointly, but the decision before the birth mom signs the relinquishment of her rights is hers, or the hers and the father's.
That's right. And the you know, the hospital is generally pretty attuned to who it is they need to listen to, but you're 100% right that it's much better if everyone is in agreement.
And this is something that's good to talk about and see if we are in agreement before him. When is the adoption finalized? Is it finalized once she signs once the birth mom and the birth dad sign the relinquishment, voluntary relinquishment of parental rights? Is that it? Is baby yours?
The adoption is not finalized, and the new parents don't become the new legal parents until the court issues a decree of adoption. And that can be weeks to months after the birth parents sign documents to start the adoption process.
Historically, I've looked it up in the past, and the average is 6 months. Is that still about right?
I'd say that's about right, but it varies. I mean, it used to be in Arkansas, you could do it in a week. And some places, it would take a year, but I still think it tends to center on about 6 months.
Okay. So do both the birth parents and the adoptive parents appear in court for the finalization?
Sometimes the birth parents need to appear in court to give their consents. But after that, I think their role with respect to the court is over. Many times the adopting parents have to come in for a final hearing for adoption, but not all states require that.
Okay. So now let's talk birth certificate. Now, there is a birth certificate. We call it the original birth certificate that lists the birth parents as the parents of the child. And then there is an altered birth certificate. So how does all of that work? First of all, who makes the decision? When is the birth certificate altered to reflect that the adoptive parents are written on there as the parents?
The new birth certificate is issued showing the new parents and sometimes the new name of the child. That's issued after the decree of adoption is issued. Often it's considered to be sort of an automatic process where paperwork goes from the court to the vital records, and the vital records sends a letter that says, here, send money to this place and you'll get your new birth certificate. That can take a very long time. And recently with the state offices with so many people working from home, it's recently taken even longer. So you can wait 6 months for your adoption decree, and then all of a sudden you find that you're waiting a new period of time for the new birth certificate. And after you get the new birth certificate, then you're waiting for a period of time to get the social security number for your child. So it is, I guess it's not over till it's over, but once the decree of adoption is signed, everything else eventually will fall into place.
A lot of times now, I think many adoptive parents want to have the original birth certificate because we hear from adult adoptees that having both birth certificates is important to them. How do parents, adoptive parents, get a copy of the original birth certificate if they want to do that for their child? Because once the new birth certificate has been issued and entered into the vital records office, I think it's very difficult to get the original birth certificate, isn't it?
It is either inconvenient to impossible, depending on the state, to get the original birth certificate after the new birth certificate has been issued. In my practice, I just make sure to get an original birth certificate for the adopting parents because it's going to be difficult later. Right. And, if you can do it for $10 now, so much the better, especially if you need the birth certificate for the court. It's just a matter of getting another copy.
So the message here for people who are listening is, if that's important to you, just make sure you ask for it. You may have to get it, but your attorney should have it. But if they don't, you write off to the vital records office, and it's, like you said, it's not expensive. It's about $10. Then you can get the original with the stamp, all that stuff.
I'm just going to mention, in an interstate adoption, you may be reaching out to another state for that birth certificate also.
Yeah, but it still doesn't cost you more. You just have to send it. Have to request for it and send your money in. All right, so now let's talk Social Security number. We need, as parents, we need Social Security numbers for our children, and oftentimes we need it relatively quickly, depending on when our taxes are due and when the baby is born. So how do adoptive parents get a Social Security number for their adopted child, either before or after the finalization?
Well, it happens two ways. If the hospital asks the birth mother, do you want us to apply for a Social Security number for the child? And she says yes, then what happens is a Social Security card for the child is mailed to the birth mother, and somebody needs to make sure that it gets forwarded to the adopting parents. If that doesn't happen, then after the adoption is completed and after the birth certificate has been issued, then the adopting parents take the birth certificate and the decree of adoption to a Social Security office and apply for a new Social Security number. Sometimes that doesn't happen in time for taxes to get done. If you need that number, for instance, for the federal adoption tax credit, the IRS will allow you to apply for something called an ATIN, Adoption Tax Identification Number. And that's something you can use for tax purposes in lieu of a Social Security number for the child for up to 2 years.
Okay, so depending on the timing of when the final adoption finalization is going to happen, you may have to do that in order to file your taxes.
Yes.
Okay. Now, do the adoptive parents need any specific legal paperwork to prove that they can make medical decisions for the child before the adoption is finalized? The child is living with them. The revocation period is over, but they have yet to appear in court, or even if they don't have to appear, the adoption has yet to be finalized. How do they make medical decisions for the child?
Well, it may be something that they have the right to do under state law, that they've been appointed guardians for the purpose of adoption, or there's a statute that says that that they have legal custody, which would give them the right to make medical decisions, or the agency has the right and can delegate that to the adopting parents. I think the best practice is for the birth mother to sign something called a healthcare power of attorney for minor that says these people have my permission to make medical decisions for the baby. Now, sometimes that's the thing that you need to convince doctors and hospitals to do what they should be doing, even though birth mother's interest in it has gone away. But that piece of paper tends to help.
So even if it's not legally necessary, it certainly may save you a great deal of headache in trying to get medical care if somebody wants to question it. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, it's much easier to show a document that says I have authority than it is to try to argue the law with somebody.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. Okay, so is there any role that Medicaid plays at this point?
Well, it plays an important role in adoption in general. Many of birth mothers will qualify for pregnant women's Medicaid.
Okay.
And generally, pregnant women's Medicaid has a higher income qualification. You know, you can make more money and get on pregnant women's Medicaid than on regular Medicaid because the state wants you to have prenatal care. Mm-hmm. And wants the baby to be delivered in a hospital. So it's good to make sure that birth mother, if she doesn't have insurance, has pregnant women's Medicaid in the state where she resides. And in some states, it will cover some of the expense or maybe all of it in the hospital for the baby. Some states read the regulations closer to how they're written, which says that the adopting parents are really the people responsible for the baby's care if the child is not going to be discharged to the birth mother. It's going to vary by jurisdiction, not necessarily because the law is different, but just because they apply it differently in different places.
Yeah, because you could see that's okay. So the birth mother the expectant mom comes in with Medicaid. She gives birth. Her child would normally be covered by Medicaid. Let's say she doesn't sign the revocation of parental rights for 3 days and the baby is in the NICU. We're talking about a fair amount of money that's accumulating for the child's care. So I guess the question would be, at that point, the child was born to a mom who was on Medicaid. Did I say Medicare? I meant Medicaid. The child was born to a mom on Medicaid. Normally, Medicaid would cover it. But in this case, if she signs the papers and 3 days later, let's say, and the adoptive parents are then, they would be wanting to put the child on their health insurance, it gets complicated, doesn't it?
Yes, we have a federal law that says that once the adopting parents become responsible for the care of the child, and that's usually when the birth mother signs her documents, then that child is as eligible to be placed on the adopting parents group insurance as a child who was born to them would be. Sometimes there's a little time in the interim where baby's born and a couple of days later the birth mother signs. Usually the insurance company will cover that. If the baby's in the NICU, then it might be worth to the insurance company to argue about that and say, okay, you know, we're not really responsible for these first 2 days. You would hope if that happens that it could be covered by Medicaid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely, at that point. Okay, something just to think about, however, from the primarily from the adoptive parent's standpoint, something to be aware of that as soon as you can, you need to put the baby onto your health insurance plan.
Yeah, I'm just going to say we have a form letter that we provide people because the insurance company is liable to come back and or the HR department and say, well, we need to see a decree of adoption or something. Well, they're just making that up. So we send them a letter, that says what the federal law is, and that tends to work pretty well.
Yeah. So if you have your HR department pushes back, then you push harder. Good. Excellent. Well, thank you so much for talking with us today about the legal process of adoption. We have been talking with Brent Wright. He is an adoption attorney. I really appreciate your time. This has been fascinating. And I think if nothing else, what we've learned is adoption is very much a legal process. So thank you, Brenton, for your time.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Let me remind everyone that the views expressed in this show are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the position of Creating a Family, our partners, or our underwriters. Also, keep in mind that the information given in this interview is general advice. It is not legal advice specific to your situation. To understand your own legal situation, you need to talk with your adoption or foster care professional. Thank you so much for joining me today, and I will see you next week.